So welcome everyone to the Scottsdale Big Book Study, where this evening or today we will crack open the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today is the 20th of April 2024, and my name is Audrey Ann, and I'm a compulsive overeater from Ireland, and I will be your host for today's study. Co-hosts are Sue L and Veronica C. If you have any questions during the meeting, please contact myself or any of the co-hosts by private message in the chat function. And the chat function will be disabled until 5 minutes before the Q&A sessions. Please note that the speaker, Harlan G, will be recorded for the duration of the study. However, the question and answer sessions which follows will not be recorded. We ask if you can please to keep yourself muted at all times during today's study, and also please turn off your video if you are exercising, eating, or if you need to step away from your screen. During the meeting, we will post the link for the seventh tradition, and the money goes towards our Zoom account, cost of uploading the recordings, and also contributions to the Intergroup and World Service. We will also post the link for the previous recordings, and these are available by clicking on the link posted in the chat box. And I will now turn you over to Harlan. Thanks, Harlan.
Thank you very much, Audrey. I do appreciate that very much. I say this all the time, but I say it today with gusto. I sincerely hope that wherever you are and whatever you're doing, whether you're listening to this on a podcast or you are listening to this live, it is as absolutely stunning where you are as it is where I am today in Scottsdale, Arizona. It's going to be in the low 90s today, and the humidity is shoe size, and I'm not sweating. I don't have the air conditioner on in my house. I'm not sweating, and it is absolutely stunning today as a day, and I hope that it is that gorgeous. We are in the chapter, There Is a Solution, chapter two. Now, what a little known fact is, this was actually the first chapter written for the book. The book did not start out with the doctor's opinion in the writing of it. It did. That came later. That came almost right as they were getting published. And it did not start out with Bill's story. Bill's story was written actually to be part of the back of the book where you have all the stories. Bill was going to be the first story. Bob was going to be the second, and so on. Well, there was a guy, and he was brought in to edit the book, and his name was Tom Uzzell. And there was another woman named Janet Blair. And Janet Blair's job was to edit the grammar and the spelling and the punctuation. And Tom Uzzell's job was to edit the content of the big book. Tom Uzzell knew Hank Parkhurst, and Hank had taken classes at a college in New Jersey, where he lived in Montclair, New Jersey. And he met Tom, or had Tom Uzzell as a teacher. And he brings in Tom Uzzell to edit the book. And what Tom did almost right off the bat was he took Bill's story and he chopped off almost half of it. Bill had gone into lengthy, copious explanations of the boomerang, and he had gone into explanations of his life in Vermont, and he had gone into different explanations. And Tom Uzzell came in and just lopped all that stuff out. And what he did, though, was it was very, very amazing what he did. You know, is it odd or is it God? Well, he took Bill's story and he moved it to chapter two. Now you may be thinking, what do you mean he moved it to chapter two? Well, you have to remember, guys, that the doctor's opinion in the first edition of the big book was chapter one. And then for the second edition, not the second printing, there's a printing is different from an edition. A printing is just a continuation of what they had been doing. An addition means they're going to sit down and they're going to reshuffle the cards. Well, when they did that, they took the doctor's opinion out of chapter one and moved it to the Roman numeral section. And the prevailing reason was Dr. Silkworth was not an alcoholic. And so the book is supposed to be written, if it's going to have the integrity that it has, it's supposed to be written for alcoholics by alcoholics. So Dr. Silkworth's opinion was moved to chapter, not ch the Roman numeral section. And Bill's story by default became chapter one. And when I say default, I just mean because doctor's opinion was, I'm doing this for Hillary just to counteract her bad cooties. I'm just doing this to counteract those bad cooties that she has wearing that imbecilic Dodger hat. But anyway, bottom line is that we have Bill's story, and in Bill's story, we have chapter one. And this was originally the first chapter written, is there is a solution. There is a solution. So the bottom line is we have been talking about one of the aspects of this disease that is not normally discussed. We talk about the twist of the mind, or what Bill calls in the 12 and 12, the mental obsession. And an obsession is something that counteracts any thought to the contrary. There are people obsessed with coin collecting. There's people obsessed with God knows what, movies or music or whatever they are. That it's very hard for these people to think about anything else. It's just, they have an obsession. An obsession is a thought which pushes aside all thought to the contrary. Now, we're very clear on discussing that with sponsees. I don't normally call it the mental obsession, because the mental obsession is not big book language. It is not big book language. Big book language is mental twist. Now, the aspect of the mental part of this that is not usually discussed is the mental blank spot. And the mental blank spot is that built-in forgetter. I have had a life, and I bet you have too, that was really negatively impacted by this disease. This disease killed every dream I could have dreamed. It killed any chance that I had for anything resembling a normal life. It killed my spirit. It killed my soul. And it destroyed my ability to think and dream and wonder what if. Because I couldn't go out there and hit a goal. I was defeated before I was started, because I just became very defeated and negative, and I don't ever want to be that way anymore. I could have done so much more. I could have done so much better with my life. Personally, professionally, you name it, I could have done so much better. But this disease not only beat me down, savagely, unmercifully beat me down, it set me on fire. And when I was screaming for mercy, when I would scream for mercy into the night, it threw gasoline on me, and it just chopped me to smithereens. This disease never let up on me at all. It never let me breathe. It never let me breathe. And this disease not only tried to kill me, what it successfully did was it choked off any life that I might have had. I know I say this a lot. I can't tell your story. I can only tell mine. I never went to the dance. I never went to homecoming. I never went to the prom. I never held a girl's hand until I was 35 years old. I never looked in the face of anybody that wasn't dripping, seething with contempt for how fat I was. I was an object of ridicule. Children would laugh at me. Adults would laugh at me. People would make me the butt of jokes. Many, many times there have been people that have treated me in the most inhumane way you can treat another person. And yet, I could be in the grocery store, standing in front of the Doritos, standing in front of the Twinkies and the Susie Q's and the whatever, what Chips Ahoy, whatever. I could be standing there in front of those products and I will buy them because my brain cannot conjure up the memory of an hour ago, a week ago, or a month ago. My brain will not let me see that this product makes me crap in my pants. This brain of mine will not allow me to see that this disease emasculated me, humiliated me, tortured me, and did things to me that if you did them to me, you would be in prison. You would be in prison. And I will buy the Chips Ahoy, and I will buy the ice cream and the pizza for later or whatever, and I will think nothing of the consequences of what those things are going to do to me. I will only focus in on what those products are going to do for me. Ice cream gives me an instant feeling of peace and comfort, but it only lasts for about 9 seconds. But for those 9 seconds, I will walk to the gates of hell and back, and I will walk there voluntarily. This disease is a murderer, and I cannot remember. I can remember so much. I have a very good memory, very good memory. People will call me. I went to Mather High School in Chicago. Who was our teacher that we had for chem? Who was our, and I'll remember. I remember the teachers that we had. They'll go, how do you remember that stuff? How do you, well, let me let you in on a secret. I wish I could take a pill and forget, you know, half the stuff. But here's why I point that out. I cannot remember that bagels and corned beef and pizza and ice cream ruined my life. I can't remember. I can't bring it to my consciousness because I don't want to. I want the effect. I want that effect, that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly by eating that food. I need it. I want it. I deserve it, and then I eat it. And that's what goes on in my brain. I bet I'm not alone. I bet you're the same way. I bet you're not alone. So with that in mind, we're on page 24, and we're going to start with the almost certain consequences. The almost certain consequences on page 24. And we're discussing the mental blank spot. Let's take a look at page 24, and we're going to be in the chapter, There Is a Solution, and the second paragraph, the almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. Let's stop right there. Never, not one time, when I wasn't in recovery, did I ever think to myself, wait a minute, if you eat these Reese's peanut butter cups, you're going to fart like a son of a bitch. You're going to crap your pants. You're going to pee your pants. This is not giving you what you want. But once my weight got past a certain level, I knew that I would never get to a normal weight, and I was never going to go on a date with a girl in my life, and I was never going to be okay, and I was never going to be able to go and live my life just like anybody else. So what's the point? I gave up. But the almost, forget about almost, forget about almost, the certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time I will be able to eat or I will be able to drink like other people. And what it says there is we shall handle ourselves like other people. My friends will go out to dinner, and a husband and a wife will order a hamburger and fries. A hamburger and fries. They split the hamburger and they each eat some of the fries. In the end of the day, and I've watched this, in the end of the day, the hamburger, neither half is consumed completely. Neither half. And there are fries left on the plate, and the busboy will come and say, "Are you done?" And they'll say, "Yes, take it away." If I had a nuclear weapon, if I had any type of weaponry, I would have unleashed it on them years ago. I would have unleashed it on them. The reason that my friends don't order a medium pizza, they order a small pizza and split it. The reason that they don't eat a medium pizza is because we're only two people. How can two people finish a medium pizza? If I had some chemical weapon to spray on them that would cause them harm, I would do it. It would be justifiable homicide. I would not be arrested. I would be canonized. I would be lifted up on the shoulders of people and I would be carried out of the restaurant if that were the case. Their brains are different than mine. And here's the kicker. Not just is it too sweet or whatever. No. You know what they'll say crazy things to me like? They'll say, "I don't want to gain any weight. I have a wedding in November. This is April. I don't want to gain any weight. I have a wedding coming up in November." Tell me a hand grenade shouldn't be the perfect weapon to throw on them at that point. "I don't want to gain any weight. I have a wedding coming up in November." Who in their right compulsive overeating mind doesn't wait till the day before the wedding or the day of the wedding to concern yourself about such things? This is crazy talk to me. So the consequences of even a glass of beer do not crowd into my brain. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. Now, when I don't remember this at all. I do not remember this at all. This is a story I was told many, many times. When I was a little boy, every Friday night, my mother would light two candles, Sabbath candles, two of them. And when I was not quite two, I crawled up on the table and I stuck my finger in the candle. And I, on the top, where it looks like water, but it's not. And I screamed bloody murder, bloody murder. To that story is attributed this. In the time since I was two, now I'm going to be 70 at the end of May. Toward the end of May, I'm going to be 70 years old. I have never stuck my hand in a candle ever again, deliberately. Anytime I have burned myself between that day and today, 100% of the time was by accident. I am careful around fire. I am careful around candles. And this is probably why, because when it comes to burning myself, my brain functions normally, just like anyone else's brain. But when it comes to food, pizza, candy, French fries, Ritz crackers burned me worse than if I was consumed by that fire. That food, those foods took my life and took me to the woodshed and beat me down like I had just robbed somebody or killed somebody. And my brain does not function normally when it comes to food. And it is only through God, it is only through a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps that one is able to recoil as if from a hot flame. There is no other way to achieve that repelling neutrality. Willpower will not do it. Desire will not do it. Smarts will not do it. I'm an intelligent person. I'm nobody's dummy. I mean, I'm not good at math, and there's many things I'm not good at, just like any of you. But I'm nobody's dummy. I don't root for the Dodgers. You don't see me doing that. But there's other people here that do. I root for the Cubs. That proves that I'm relatively okay, right? You're righteous in rooting for the Cubs. You're evil if you root for the Dodgers or the Yankees or the Angels or the Mets. That's an evil thing to do. It goes against God. But the bottom line is, I'm a reasonable person, but I cannot talk myself out of putting those Reese's peanut butter cups in my mouth just because I want to. Wanting not to eat Reese's peanut butter cups will dry up like a snowball in July, because those Reese's peanut butter cups are going to do something for me, that nothing else except a spiritual awakening will do for me. What is it that those Reese's peanut butter cups do for me? They give me an instant sense of ease and comfort. And that's called the effect. And this mental blank spot is not discussed enough by sponsors. Sponsors, from what I can tell in 45 years of haunting these rooms, do not explain this. Maybe they don't understand it themselves. Maybe their sponsor didn't teach it to them. But this mental blank spot is as if as it as as bleh, it is as lethal a part of the illness as anything else. It is the sidekick of the mental twist. It is the sidekick of what later is called the mental obsession. It is the sidekick. And this mental blank spot is why people whose lives have been torn to shreds will go right back into Dunkin' Donuts, right back into a bar, right back to the drug dealer, right back into a casino or a bookie's office, and they will further dig themselves death. The twist of the mind is always accompanied by, aided and abetted by the mental blank spot. Remember the story of Bill Wilson at the end of his drinking career? He goes to golf, and the bus gets into an accident, and he starts drinking at the bar after telling this guy that he shouldn't drink and all the things that we are absolutely thought of as crazy or stupid. My friends do not understand recovery. They don't understand recovery. They think I've just wised up, that all of a sudden I got smart rather than stupid, that now I have willpower that I didn't have before. Now I get it. Now I understand that Harlan doesn't want to be fat anymore. What I cannot explain to them is I never wanted to be fat. I never wanted to be 335 pounds as a senior in high school. I never wanted to be 600 pounds by the time I graduated college. I never wanted that. It happened so people think, well, you must like it. Because in their life, in their non-addicted life, they were able to choose what they liked and what they didn't like and go after that. They didn't understand that I was under the gun of something I didn't choose, I can't cure, and I cannot control. And that is the disease of compulsive overeating. I didn't get this because I'm stupid. I didn't get this because I lived in Chicago. I didn't get this because I'm not good at math or that I had black hair. I didn't get this because I'm left-handed. I got this because I got this. This isn't because of some other person. My mother was mentally ill. My father was old when I was born. He was 54 years old when I was born. By the time I entered kindergarten, he was 59 years old. People always asked us, "Is that your grandson? Is that your grandson?" And my dad would say, "No, he's my Zun," which means, Nish, he's my Zun means no, he's my son. And people were astounded. My dad wasn't one generation in front of me, he was two. He was older than many of the grandparents of my friends. Did I get this disease because of that? No. No. Did I get this disease because I went to Mather High School in Chicago? No. No, I didn't. Did I get this disease because I liked sweets or I liked whatever? No. Probably didn't like them any more than anybody else did or less. But they did something for me that nothing else could do for me. They gave me peace. They settled me down. And Bill Wilson and Dr. Silkworth call that the effect. Bill, not Bill Wilson, Dr. Silkworth, not Bill Wilson. Dr. Silkworth calls it the effect, that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly by eating certain foods. I know I'm spending a lot of time on this. But the reason that I'm spending a lot of time on this is vital information. And it is not information that I'm hearing sponsors teaching to their sponsees. I'm just not hearing a lot of this. That's why we're spending a lot of time on it. It's vital information. This information alone, however, will not keep you from the food. The only thing that's going to keep you from the food is a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. That's it. Nothing else will work. The knowledge of this will not change it. I'm going to say that again. The knowledge of this will not help you. It won't change it. The only thing that will help you is a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. That's the only thing that is going to help you. Let's continue. The alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, "It won't burn me this time, so here's how." Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often have some of us begun to drunk in this nonchalant way, and after the third or fourth, pounded on the bar and said to ourselves, "For God's sakes, how did I ever get started again?" Only to have that thought supplanted by, "Well, I'll stop with the sixth drink," or my favorite refrain, "What's the use anyhow?" And people would say to me, "You're going to die." And I'd say, "Oh, good." And I'd say, "Hey, we all got to go sometime, but I'm going out with a full stomach." Just like when I used to smoke cigarettes. People would say, "You know, those will kill you." And I'd say, "Man, but not fast enough." You know what? This is the only life we have. This is not a dress rehearsal. This is not a dress rehearsal. When I was a little boy, my father's friends, not all of them, but many of them, were from concentration camps in Europe. And they would all say the same thing to me, even though they didn't conspire this. They didn't conspire to say this to me. This is what they would say to me repeatedly. Live until you die. Live until you die. And the life that we have every single day is the most precious commodity there is. We're all going to die. Everyone here will be dead in 100 years. 100 years from now, none of us will be around. I can't guarantee it because I won't be here. But 100 years from now, we're going to be gone. Some of us will be remembered. Some of us may not. I don't know. I have no idea. But here's what I do know. If you're struggling right now, or you're in the food and you're struggling, you're in the food, do whatever the hell you need to do, because you're never going to get another chance at today. And if you will just take today and do the right thing, you'll hate yourself a little less. And you'll hate yourself a little less every single day that you are able to do that. Doing self-esteemable activities is the number one way of getting out of the self-loathing that this disease produces. Let's continue. We're at the bottom of page 24. When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. These stark and ugly facts have been confirmed by legions of alcoholics, top of 25, throughout history. But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop, but cannot. We have to turn to our power, our higher power, if we're going to get out of this maze of insanity. We are going to have to turn to God. We are going to have to do that in the working of the steps. I had to stop looking for solution on earth. There's no earthly explanation for this. There is no earthly solution to this. Money won't fix you. Love, romance, sex, fame, fortune will not fix this. A new attitude toward living will not fix this. A reserve of willpower will not fix this, because this disease is more powerful than any power of will that the brain who puts you in this can get you out of. The same brain that condemned you to a compulsive overeating death is not the brain that is going to get you out of this. Stop trying to figure it out. Stop trying to understand it and do it. By doing it, you figure it out and you understand it. By waiting till you understand it, you will be in trouble or dead before anything happens. Stop trying to figure this out. I get this phone call almost every day of my life. I'm trying to figure out step six. I'm trying to figure out step four. I'm trying to figure out step three. Stop trying to figure it out and just do it. And when you do it, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. You're going to have a new freedom and a new serenity and a new happiness. You're going to be amazed. Stop trying to figure it out. I'm explaining what's going on to you. Take me at value, because I'm telling you what I know. I'm telling you what I know. And it's not going to change unless God changes it. Whatever you believe in, be you an agnostic, be you an atheist, whether your God is a doorknob. Doorknobs seem to be very popular in OA as gods. Doorknobs, dogs, cats. I had Lake Michigan for a while. whatever it is that you have as your higher power, lean into that higher power and do the work and stop trying to figure it out. You'll be amazed before you are halfway through. Let's go to page 25. There is a solution. Thank God. We've talked about this a lot. There is a solution. For thousands of years, there was no solution. None. Zero. There was no solution. Almost none. I'm on page 25. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. In other words, you're going to have to work the steps and stop trying to figure it out and stop waiting to understand. Just walk through the work. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. Many, many years ago, when I was very young, I was 25 years old when this occurred, 24, 25 years old, on a very miserable February afternoon. So I must have been 25, because I came in February of when I was 24. I went down to the Lincoln Park Alano Club in Chicago. The Lincoln Park Alano Club is in Lincoln Park, obviously. And that's a part of Chicago. And they had meetings there at 2:15 or 2:15. That's a weird time to start a meeting, 2:15, but that's what they did. 2:15 to 4 o'clock. And they were speaker meetings, and there was a smoke break in the middle of the meeting. So these were most of our meetings in Chicago at that time were 90-minute meetings. And the reason they were 90-minute meetings is so you could smoke and socialize in the middle. As more and more of the locations wouldn't let us smoke, they made the meetings an hour. But at that time, I went to see a guy by the name of Wino Joe Leaf. Very, very famous circuit speaker, but filthy dirty. I mean, every other word out of his mouth was F and this and MF and all this other stuff. I mean, he was filthy. And there were people that didn't like that. And to this, I don't know about to this dash. When I was there, there was a sign in the front of the Lincoln Park Alano Club. Lack of swearing or elimination of swearing will offend no one. Well, he was filthy dirty, but he did get off a good one. He said, and I'm quoting Wino Joe, if you want to hit bottom, stop digging. If you think you have not hit your bottom yet, then you haven't. But that's a choice you can make. Now, you're going to ask me in the questions and answers, what do you mean it's a choice I can make? You just told me I'm powerless. You just told me I can't do that. You can take action after action to recover. And that will stop the behaviors that are making you worse and worse. It's a progressive disease. It's going to get worse no matter what. But if you take action after action after action after action, you will find that your life will get much better quickly. Let's continue. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved. Notice it doesn't say cured. The problem has been solved. Is that a permanent condition? No. No, it's not. There was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. What are those tools? The steps. We're not talking about the tools of OA. Phone call, sponsorship, writing, meetings. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the steps. So the word tools can be confusing. Here he calls the steps tools. Other places he calls them principles. Other places he calls them The steps, other places he calls them rules. So he's talking about the steps. He's not talking about the tools. We have found much of heaven and had been rocketed. What a great metaphor. Catapulted, rocketed. These are the metaphors that Bill uses to illustrate his point, and he illustrates it beautifully. Rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Do you remember when it says in Bill's story, I had been rocketed into a fourth dimension? Well, the first three dimensions are height, width, and length. The fourth dimension is the dimension of the spiritual, of God, the spiritual. You have been rocketed. We have been rocketed, not sent, not walked, rocketed into the fourth dimension, which is the dimension of the spiritual. What a beautiful metaphor that is. How God-inspired is this book? How unbelievably God-inspired is this book? It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. Page 25, middle of the page. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. Remember, the book was written primarily by Bill. He doesn't really look at spiritual awakenings until Appendix 2, which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives. Notice I didn't say lives. A lot of people read it that way. I'm going to explain why I read it as lives. Lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. The reason I like to read it as hearts and lives is because God to me is alive. And what can living things do that dead things cannot do? Living things can grow, change, adapt, metamorphosize, which are words for the same basic thing. I need a living God. I need a God that is living because I am going to run into things today. I have a heavy heart today in a certain area of my very heavy heart. I have a lot of uncertainty in my life. I have a lot of fear and anger and selfishness in my life and all kinds of things going on because I'm human, not because I'm a compulsive overeater, because I'm human. And as a human being, I'm going to face these uncertainties and these fears and these disturbances to the force. And I need a God to rise to that challenge with me and for me so I don't have to eat, so I don't have to go kill myself with food. I don't want to die. I used to want to die. I don't want to die today. I want to live. And I want to live until I die. I want every moment to be maximized. I want every moment of my life to be good, to mean something, to help others, to do whatever it takes so that when I get to God at the end of my days, He will extend His hand and hug me and say, you got off to a pretty rocky start there, but you really came around. Good job. That's what I want. I want him to tell me that I did a good job. And the only way for me to do a good job is to be in recovery. I can't do a good job if I'm loaded down with pizza and cookies and Ritz crackers and all this other stuff. Can't do it. Maybe others can. Maybe there's people out there that could be in the food and drinking and doing all kinds of crazy things to themselves, and they can function beautifully. I can't. And because I can't, I know I need God's help, because I cannot achieve these things by myself on my own. I have to have God's help. Let's continue. We're at the bottom of page 25. If you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle of the road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. That describes me. And if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. And the other is to accept spiritual help. This we did, top of 26. This we did because we honestly wanted to and were willing to make the effort. I want to live. But here's what didn't happen to me. Here's what did not happen to me. I didn't say I want to live and then work the program. I worked the program, and then the desire to live came upon me. I want to repeat that because it's important. I didn't wake up in the morning with this willingness to do whatever they told me to do. Far from it. Far from it. I started working the program because I saw it was working in others, and I figured it's never going to work for me. But if I can prove to these people that it's not going to work for me, which is the ego has three jobs: make me right, make me feel good right now, and make me different from everybody else. I was going to prove to them that this program would not work for me. So I started working it, and lo and behold, I wanted to live. Lo and behold, I now believe that not only will it work for me, it will work for anybody who does the work. You know where it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path? I've never seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Not one time. Not one time. Because when I walk to God, God runs to me. When I call the name of God and I say, I'm hurting, I'm uncertain, I'm scared, I'm jealous, I'm angry, I'm hurting, I'm lonely, He runs to me. But I don't just sit there and make demands and say, God, I need help. I take action. What kind of action do I take? I make an outreach call. I go to my meeting. I help people. I do the best I can. Whether this is your first time listening to my Saturday morning big book study, or it's your many times listening to my big book story, know this: when I'm done here and I go to my lunch with my friends, I'm tired because I give this everything I have. And the reason that I give this everything that I have has nothing to do with you. I hope you recover. Some of you are sound asleep. I can see it. Some of you are not here. I can't see them, but some of you have chosen not to come here today. And some of you are going to get nothing from this. And some of you are going to think, this was really good. I'm going to do this, this, and this. I really don't care. I'm here because by serving God, I get a good day. The chances that I'm going to compulsively overeat today are very, very remote. Very remote. I'm going to do the best I can to recover. I'm going to do the best I can to help anyone that comes in my path. But I'm going to do these things knowing that the one that's going to benefit the most is me. So don't think for 5 minutes that I'm not giving this all I have. I may not be great. There may be other big book people that are more interesting to listen to. I can't make that judgment for you. What I can tell you is I give this my all because I want to live. There's no sense in me coming here to do a half-assed job. There's just no sense to it. I'm not going to do that. And besides, if I did, you'd pick up on that and you wouldn't come back. I'd be sitting here eventually, I'd be sitting here talking to myself. I give this every, when you come to the Scottsdale meetings, Sunday through Friday, I do the best I can there in the questions and answers. I tell people things they don't want to hear. I don't like doing that. I want everybody to like me too, but that's not possible. That's not possible. So we have been instructed to go to Appendix 2. Now, in the years gone by, I have read Appendix 2, but I'm going to tell you what it says. And if you really want to read it, it's on page 567. Read it yourself. I recommend you do. But Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob and some of the early guys had what are called spiritual experiences. In other words, very sudden and very profound. And they were altered immediately and completely, but not permanently. Some of them went back to drinking. I never had that. I had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. What is the difference? A spiritual experience is very quick, very sudden, and very profound. Bill Wilson always said that when he was in the town's hospital in December of 34, God came to him and filled the room with light. And when he filled the room with light, Bill's life was changed forever. I did not have that kind of experience. What I had is a spiritual awakening, very slow, of the educational variety. Is one better than the other? I couldn't tell you. I don't know. I don't know. I would strongly suggest that if you're confused about that, go to page 567 when we're done. And read Appendix 2. People were writing into the OA, the AA office, and they're saying, "Bill, I'm doing everything you're describing, but I'm not having this spiritual experience." So he started writing back, and then for the second edition of the big book, he wrote Appendix 2, and he changed the wording of Step 12. See how you always say in meetings that the book has never been changed? That's not true. He changed the 12th step from having had a spiritual experience, he changed it to having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So he changed it. Now, he's going to refer back to this. Spiritual experience appendix two several more times in once more in this chapter and then again in the next chapter. He's going to refer to it several times. It must be pretty darn important. Spiritual experience, very quick, very sudden. Spiritual awakening, slow to develop. Is one better than the other? Couldn't tell you. I don't know. Next week, we're going to be talking about Roland Hazard, who in 1931 sought out the services of Dr. Jung in Geneva, Switzerland. And when he sought out the services of Dr. Jung in 1931, it was part of the tapestry that God will use to bring this fellowship on earth. He will use this as a way of creating what we have. The disease comes from Dr. Silkworth. Not the disease, but the explanation of the disease comes from Silkworth. The solution, the spiritual awakening, comes from Jung. We're going to be talking about that next week. We're also going to be hoping to finish the chapter. Maybe we will, and maybe we won't. I don't know. We'll see. If we get there, we get there. But we're going to be talking about Roland Hazard. And as I'm going to again talk about next week, Roland will tell Ebby. Ebby will tell Bill. And Bill will tell the world of what we have found here. So in review, this mental blank spot, the built-in forgetter, is part of the killing machinery that this disease will bring upon you to cause you to die way before your time, never having lived. And this is what you don't want to do. You don't want to ignore this with your sponsees. You want to make sure that you take this and you teach it, because this built-in forgetter never, ever, ever, ever goes away. I have been in recovery for a long time. If I stop working my program, if I stop praying, if I stop holding God's hand, if I stop serving God, I will be ordering pizza with double pepperoni and double sausage, just like I used to. And then I will start ordering them two at a time. I came to a point where I couldn't order just one extra large family size pizza. I had to order two of them. And they would bring me my pizzas two at a time. And I will be doing that, and it will seem like the most natural thing in the world to me. It will seem normal and natural to be eating 20, 30 candy bars a day. It will seem very normal and very natural to be eating several pounds of Doritos a day, because this is who I am at my core. I am a compulsive overeater. I do not have any power over food. I am powerless. And this built-in forgetter is one of the important ways that the disease will kill me. It will kill me. So it's very important that I teach this, because I can't remember it on my own. I will only remember it if I teach this information to others. If you are a sponsor, stop ignoring that and teach it so you can remember it. If you're a sponsee, don't ever forget this. You don't remember the consequences of a day, a week, or a month ago. Okay, before I turn it back over to Sue, I'm going to ask you that if you asked the question last week, wait till there's a lull in the action, and please don't give me any food questions or any math questions. I'm not good at math, and the food is not something I want to discuss here. And for the love of God, don't wear Dodger regalia, because they just suck. They suck. They buy any free agent they want, and there's no limit to what they can spend, and it just sucks. This is the team to root for, Chicago Cubs. They are righteous. They are God's team, no question about it, and this is the team you should be rooting for. They're playing a doubleheader today because of a rainout on Thursday. They're on in the afternoon and the evening. Okay, Sue,